From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. As the week ends, we're looking back at some of our favorite conversations. Author Jonathan Merritt grew up in a prominent Baptist family. When he moved from the Bible Belt to New York City, he discovered a dearth of people carrying on conversations about spirituality or faith. Well, he dove into that void, gathering data and talking with linguists and regular folks all across the country. I talked with him about his new book, Learning to Speak God from Scratch, and asked him what speaking God means.
You know, I thought it would be fun to kind of coin a phrase. I mean, it's a book about language after all. And so I say in the book, when I got to New York, I ran into a language barrier, and it wasn't that I could no longer speak English, but I could no longer speak God, which means I was really having trouble having spiritual or religious conversations in general and using some of the words from the vocabulary of faith that I had grown up using all of my life.
And you even were questioned on using simple phrases like God bless you when people sneezed, you know, questioned about what do you mean God or bless? So what do you do in those situations?
Well, you know what the sad part of this is, what I did and what most people do is we just stopped speaking God at all. Because when somebody says to you, what do you mean when you say bless? What do you mean when you say grace? What do you mean when you say saved? What you start to realize is that even for an experienced God speaker like me, what happens is you start to realize not only do they not really understand what you mean, but you're not so sure you understand what you mean anymore either. I mean, a lot of us who grew up in the South or grew up in largely Christian context, how often do we stop and ask, what am I saying when I'm saying what I'm saying? Most of us don't. We never stop to question the words we're using. And so when we find ourselves in a context where someone does question those words, we precipitously lose confidence in those words, and then we stop having spiritual conversations altogether.
Well, you commissioned a study to see if those kind of disconnects happen to other people. This is a survey of 1,000 people. You found a fifth had not had a spiritual conversation in all of last year or the year preceding that. So by your study's count, only 7% of Americans talk about God on a regular basis. Why is that?
There are a number of reasons, and it's even worse than I thought when I first saw these numbers. I said, okay, only 7%? 7% of Americans, because, you know, 70.8% of Americans claim to be Christian, and there's some sort of breakdown happening. But when I decided, well, maybe that's just picking up on a lot of more secular or non-religious folks. So I decided to look at the practicing Christians in the survey, just people who say that they go to church regularly. I figured that number would go sky high. It would be really encouraging. And that number was actually really low, too. Only 1 in 8 practicing Christians say that they have a conversation about faith on a regular basis. So Americans are not speaking God. Why not? Well, we decided to ask folks. The number one reason is, you know, spiritual and religious conversations tend to create tension or arguments. And of course, if you've ever been at a Thanksgiving dinner with Uncle Philip shaking a drumstick at you, telling you what he believes the Bible says, you know what that feels like and why you might avoid it. There are other people who say that religious language has become too politicized. And of course, if you're on Twitter, if you watch cable news, you know exactly what this is like, because today you have pastors speaking like politicians and politicians speaking like pastors. And that sort of desacralizes religious language, and it causes people to avoid it. Another really common answer people gave is that they'd been hurt by these words. They say, you know, my pastor or my parent or my friends used spiritual words, religious words, to shame me or scold me, repress me or oppress me. And when you have a negative memory attached to religious language, you stop using it. So there are a range of reasons why people don't use it, but most Americans, the vast majority of us, say that we are no longer confident to have spiritual or religious conversations in everyday life.
Yeah, so people think that they don't really know how to use those words. They feel ignorant, you know, they don't understand them. Now, there's a word I'm going to pick up on because there are several in this book that you really dive into, like brokenness. Now, that was a word that set off a dilemma for you a couple of years ago. What? Why was that?
You know, it sure did, because I say this early on in the book, that some of these words I chose and some of the words chose me. And brokenness was one of those words. A few years ago, I had spoken about sexual orientation, sexual minorities, in speaking of my own orientation. And I had defined it as being broken. And that sort of is a way that that word has been used in a lot of conservative Christian circles, that people who are not heteronormative, people who do not sort of conform to the kind of expected, the majority orientation, that we say, oh, they're broken, and that it assumes something went wrong. I mean, first of all, the question is, who broke it? And then how can it be fixed? And of course, what we know when it comes to sexual orientation now is, we've got a lot of great data on this, is when you try to, quote, fix sexual orientation, which is to say, to make a gay or a bisexual person straight, it doesn't work. And so what I say in the book is maybe we shouldn't use a word like brokenness or broken, and maybe I shouldn't have used that word to talk about individuals who are not broken, who haven't been broken, and who there is no possibility of, quote, fixing.
So it's not that you don't use that word anymore, but as you write about, sort of reconceptualizing these words, creating a meaning for them, founded in scripture in many cases and conversation. But I wonder, does that set you up for the charge of bending the word of God to your own will?
You know, I spent about 4.5 years writing this book, and I spent about 1 year studying linguistics. And what I found out really quickly is that linguists are like pastors. They're like columnists. They're like radio hosts. They don't agree on everything, but they do agree on this. Language either changes or it dies, and there is no exception to that. It will change or it will die. Every language is moving at any time toward either evolution or extinction. The thing that keeps a language alive is that the speakers are constantly wrestling with it, rethinking it, reconceptualizing it, critiquing it, reimagining it, to sort of confront the needs of their day. And I think that's what we have to do with a lot of these words, is really to start wrestling with them again so that they work for us once more.
I want to pick up on what you were talking about politicization of sacred words. And in the book, you specifically cite examples from Presidents George Bush and Donald Trump about that. And I wonder, given what you said about people avoiding talking about this because it makes them uncomfortable or they are risking conflict, if this is a kind of, you know, dog whistle to the faithful that I can be bold about saying these things, though you might be afraid.
I did a YouTube series recently where I went down to Times Square and I asked people that question. Does it bother you? And, you know, I heard a lot of people say, it depends. That was a real common answer, and it was one that surprised me. And when I said, depends on what, they said, it depends on who is saying it and why they're saying what they're saying. That if it's somebody who is believably religious, that has kind of a track record of being religious, then they're okay with it. And if they have somebody, a politician who's using religious language, say, for example, to celebrate the diversity of faith in America, that's okay with them. But if they're using it in a way that's manipulative, that doesn't really work, because it's clear you're using this language, this scripture verse, as a means to an end and not an end in itself. And so, yes, there is some nuance there. It's not religion and politics mixing is always bad, and a politician can never talk about faith in a way that is good or helpful. I think there are a lot of Americans who appreciate a president who has some sense of faith or religion or a higher power, but it's when that is used as a tool of coercion or manipulation that really tends to make that language feel toxic for a lot of Americans, who say, you know what, this is holy language, and it shouldn't just be another tool in a politician's tool belt.
I want to pull at some of the threads that I'm hearing and read in the book about your encounter with a woman who is from the Baha'i faith, and you guys, you know, just really didn't understand each other. In this idea of evolving language, is there an assumption that we can share a common language as a culture or variety of cultures about belief?
You know, there are some words that cross over, but they have different meanings. So a word like justice or mercy, love, you're going to find these words in a lot of the world's great faiths. There are other words that are specific to certain faith walks. But I think something that I found that was interesting in this book is, and it goes back to Google. You know, these days I feel like the world is the 6 degrees of Google. Everything goes back to Google. So it's no surprise that this conversation goes back as well to Google. Google has compiled, going back to 1500, all of the words in the English language that were published in books, magazine articles, pamphlets, speeches, web pages, and they're searchable. So you can actually search the frequency of word usage at any given time. What we find is, when we analyze this data, is that there has been a massive decline in religious words that all faiths use, since about the mid-20th century. They've been declining by up to 50% or more. But here's something that's interesting, particularly for non-religious people. There's actually been a decrease in not just religious language, but there has been a decrease in that, but also the language of virtue, ethics, and morality. So words like courage have declined precipitously. Compassion words have declined. Kindness words have declined. The word grace has declined. These represent things that I think bind us together as human beings. I would imagine most people listening to this would say, I want to live in a world that's courageous and kind and compassionate and gracious. And yet, you look around at our world today and it's not kind or compassionate or gracious. And what we're realizing is that we've been shaping this culture through the words that we use or the words that we don't use for a very long time, that there is a connection between what we talk about and what we think about, and a connection between what we think about and the way that we behave and live as individuals and as a culture.
That's author Jonathan Merritt. His new book is called Learning to Speak God from Scratch. And that sparked a lively conversation on Facebook and Twitter about the language and practice of belief in the South. Becca Ford on Facebook said one of the reasons she left the church was because of a lack of concern for social justice, the environment, and the icky relationship between conservative Christians and the worst of our politicians. Well, that relationship between politics and the pulpit came up during my discussion with a group of local church leaders. Pastor Wilbur Purvis III of Destiny World Church encouraged his congregation to just do it and proudly wear Nike in support of the company's deal with former NFL quarterback Colin Kaepernick. Pastor Purvis says to him, social issues are religious discussions.
I think the gospel of Jesus Christ, it is a social gospel. It's concerned about the whole man, spiritually, financially, socially. And I think that's what God calls us to, what Jesus calls us to do. This is not a Democrat or a Republican thing. This is, how do we make our community better?
You can follow up on that discussion at OST Talk on Twitter or on our Facebook group. Just ahead, a tasty treat that people around the world depend on every day, bugs. But first, we're going to revisit the strategy that made the South red and the man who mastered it. This is On Second Thought. From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. Earlier this week, we explored the frequently repeated idea that Georgia is turning blue. So for context, we looked into the race-based political tactics that helped turn the South red and the influential political strategist who mastered it. I spoke with Stefan Forbes, producer and director of the 2008 documentary Boogeyman, the Lee Atwater story, and asked him for a little history on the Southern strategy.
In the Southern strategy, you never talked about race explicitly. That was the whole key. It was plausible deniability. So you came up with code words like busing or fair housing legislation, things that actually were wedge issues for white people in the North, because it was easy for most white people to get behind ending Jim Crow. But things that touched suburban New York or Chicago, you know, you could win over these Reagan Democrats to the Republican Party. And if you look at the effect of that, the school system in New York is still separate and unequal, you know, 100 years after slavery. So this stuff worked. It forestalled real political change. And the best thing about it was you could always say it never worked. It never existed. And people still do that today, even though you had heads of the RNC like Ken Melman and Michael Steele apologize for the Southern strategy. People still deny that it was ever used.
Yes, Barry Goldwater's biographer wrote, "It is a way to win the vote of racists without sounding like racists." And into this backdrop, after decades of that, comes Lee Atwater, Atlanta-born, raised in South Carolina, a young Republican. Help paint a picture of this character.
You know, Lee's favorite thing was being misunderstood by his opponents. They saw him as a dumb country boy, you know, barefoot, guitar-picking Southerner who, you know, he went to Newberry College, just barely a college. He didn't grow up in Harvard Yard. Everything that they saw as his shortcoming and his weakness, Lee Atwater turned into a strength. And before he was done, he completely revolutionized American politics and had a huge hand in the Southernification of the GOP.
In the film, the people that you speak to portray him more as an opportunist than an ideologue. What did you discover about his motivation?
Well, yeah, I mean, the best political operatives have, shall we say, a moral flexibility that allows them to do whatever it's going to take to win. You know, he was completely Machiavellian. Some people thought he could have become a Democrat just as easily, but he saw this huge youth gap in the Republican Party. And he realized this was the place to get ahead. This is the way to make a career. And when he did, it was really a decision that changed America. And I'm sure we'll get into the amazing transformation that he wreaked on our country. It's incredible what this one guy did. And it's ironic, too, that a lot of Democrats still don't really know who he was, and they don't know how to fight the campaign tactics that he pioneered in presidential elections.
The 1988 campaign of George H.W. Bush was where Atwater really made his mark. What made him so effective?
Well, you know, it's still one of the greatest come-from-behind victories in American political history. George Herbert Walker Bush, this elitist, kind of wussy, wimpy guy perceived as a totally ineffectual leader, was down 17 points after the Democratic convention. People had written him off. They were talking about President Dukakis. And Lee pulled off a feat of political jujitsu that is stunning. And the way he did it was by bringing Southern stump politics, which were really the province of local, state, and congressional races, into presidential politics for really the first time in 100 years.
And what does Dukakis do? Every time he stands up, he attacks George Bush. He's a hypocrite. We all know that. You know it, too. That is reflective of the kind of out-of-touch crowd they are. They probably sat up in Brookline eating Belgium endives and a quiche out of the can.
He knew that he had to make things ugly. He had to use wedge politics, the politics of fear. He had to impugn Dukakis's manhood the way people would do on a stump down south. And he knew that these people from Harvard Yard, like Susan Estrich, would have no idea how to combat this stuff. It didn't work so well with Clinton and James Carville 4 years later, who had studied this stuff happening. But in 1988, it was a knockout punch.
He did play up his own regions, the Southern regions' mistrust of these Eastern elites. Did it hit its mark?
Yeah, totally. And I mean, it's one of the great feats of political rhetoric that the party that was always helping the working class got rebranded as these Volvo-driving, Chardonnay-sipping liberal elites. You know, it's something that's still working today. It's yielding incredible fruit in politics, and the Democrats still don't really know how to come back against that stuff. But it was the politics of resentment that Lee understood incredibly well. And ironically, if the Democrats had learned from Atwater, hadn't just written him off and looked down on him morally, which is understandable, they'd know how to fight against a guy like Donald Trump. Donald Trump calling Jeff Sessions a dumb Southerner. Here's a guy with a law degree. He's the highest ranking law enforcement official in the land. You're going to impugn him like that and, you know, calling him mentally retarded. That strikes such a deep chord across the South that Lee Atwater could have gone to town with that. And these are essential parts of American political discourse that the Democrats still don't understand how deep those veins of resentment run.
We're getting a masterclass on a master of the Southern strategy with Stefan Forbes, who produced and directed the 2008 documentary Boogeyman, the Lee Atwater story. So Atwater helped to plant rumors about Elizabeth Dole during the primaries, trying to cut away at the leads or popularity of Bob Dole. But as you point out, particularly pointed in the post-convention general election against Dukakis. Now, you said Dukakis up 17 points during the Atlanta convention, but that number decreased following this disturbing ad.
Bush supports the death penalty for first-degree murderers. Dukakis not only opposes the death penalty, he allowed first-degree murderers to have weekend passes from prison. One was Willie Horton, who murdered a boy in a robbery, stabbing him 19 times. Despite a life sentence, Horton received 10 weekend passes from prison. Horton fled, kidnapped a young couple, stabbing the man and repeatedly raping his girlfriend. Weekend prison passes. Dukakis on crime.
Willie Horton, the prisoner mentioned there, became infamous, an African-American man, so clearly playing race in this game. Was that the deciding factor in the 1988 Bush-Dukakis election?
You know, I don't think you can ever point to one deciding factor. They accused his wife, Kitty Dukakis, of burning a flag. President Reagan accused Michael Dukakis of insanity. I mean, it was all part and parcel of the politics of personal destruction. They went to Texas and told everyone that Dukakis was going to take everyone's gun away. But there were interesting things going on underneath the surface. In that campaign, Lee Atwater was the first to also recognize the incredible political potential of the candidate's son, George W. Bush, who had a drinking problem and who it never really amounted to much. And it's amazing in the film, we kind of get to look at this footage of W growing up under Lee's expert tutelage and becoming this bare-knuckled political brawler. It's an amazing transformation. And for Atwater to do that, he was incredibly guilty about having done that. He was a guy who idolized black musicians, who kind of saw himself as a figure that could bridge these two worlds. He palled around with James Brown and B.B. King. And I know that personally, for him as a Southerner to do this, it was painful, but he knew that this was the way to win.
So against that, we have the seemingly conflicting message of Atwater from a tape here speaking in 1981. Now, this tape was handed over to James Carter IV, and we do warn you the sentiment is pretty offensive.
You start out in 1954 by saying, by 1968, you can't say that hurts your backfire, so you say stuff like forced busing, states' rights, and all that stuff. And you're getting so abstract now, you're talking about cutting taxes, and all of these things you're talking about are totally economic things, and the byproduct of them is blacks get hurt worse than whites.
So there's Atwater in 1981. N-word is what he's saying there. Stefan Forbes, how do you reconcile these two sides of this man?
Well, you know, as a Southerner, he knew what would work in national presidential elections. You know, we inherit this toxic legacy as Americans. The politics of fear have been practiced on us for centuries. And, you know, our internal guilt at the violence that we've done to black people is transmogrified into this projection of all these evil values onto them as predators, as, you know, criminals. And so, you know, racism hurts white Americans in this really devious way. Atwater understood the subtleties of that. He knew how to play upon those fears without really doing it overtly. And, you know, it's unfortunately, it took a Southerner who really understood these views to bring them back into the mainstream of American politics to the point where once it started working so well, it became almost inevitable that these kind of tactics would be used and that we would get a Donald Trump calling white nationalists very fine people and using the playbook of the boogeyman to just totally concentrate political power in the era that we're living in now. It's quite disturbing.
Well, Lee Atwater was diagnosed with a brain tumor. He apologized for his depiction of Willie Horton and things that he said about Michael Dukakis. Now, this was shortly before he died. Do the people you interviewed for the film think that Lee Atwater was sincere in those apologies?
You know, like everything else about the guy, that is a totally divisive topic. You know, he was terrified that he was going to hell for the things he had done. Were they explicitly racial? Was it the politics of personal destruction? People like Mary Madeline believe that, you know, ironically, Lee, who had demonized so many other people, has been demonized since his death, that his political acumen, his insight into the power of class as well as race, and his, you know, incredible political jujitsu, his joyful kind of assuming of the mantle of bad boy, you know, was a way of signaling to the press with a wink and a nod that, you know, these things are okay. It's the way politics is done. He did a lot to legitimize these really nasty tactics in the Washington political establishment. And, you know, a lot of his defenders feel that, ironically, he's been demonized for that since his death. And letting other people off the hook, you know, you got to wonder when Trump is gone, how fast, you know, Republicans will be dropping him like a hot potato and saying, ah, you know, he happened to win. We didn't like any of that stuff. The fact is it delivered them electoral victories and it's given them seats on the Supreme Court and wholesale rewriting of the tax code. There are fruits of these tactics of racism and divisiveness. And we have to be really clear that when you engage in this kind of politics, you're going to be called out on it.
Well, Barbara Bush famously disliked Lee Atwater. She thought he was crude. He definitely broke political norms. Is that part of the Lee Atwater legacy? And what has that meant for politics since?
Lee Atwater was a godsend for George Herbert Walker Bush, one of the waspiest of GOP candidates. He was a throwback to the Rockefeller Republicans. He really couldn't win in 1988. Lee, who loved professional wrestling, he read the National Enquirer. He had a Fellini-esque sense of the American electorate. He was able to coat this patrician wasp with the patina of cowboy boots and Texas cowboy hats. And he was able to paint George Bush as a flag-waving redneck, which was an incredible achievement. And Lee welcomed in a whole new class of people into the GOP. He used W as his point man to outreach to Southern evangelicals who had been really resistant to enter politics, to bring politics into the pulpit. Lee created a political juggernaut down South by giving his party's really questionable economic and racial tactics the moral a sort of moral blessing from the pulpit. I think you can see Lee Atwater's massive effect in American politics, most simply in the character of our president today. In 2016, the thought of President Donald Trump was a joke to most Americans. Back in 1988, Lee actually suggested him as VP to George Herbert Walker Bush, who wrote about it in his diary, said it was strange and unbelievable. Lee saw even back then where American politics was heading and where he was planning to drag it, that the key things would be a resentment against elites, this everyman outsider attitude, blunt talk, racial animus, a killer instinct, and a tabloid sensibility. You could see it all in Donald Trump.
That was Stefan Forbes, who produced and directed the documentary Boogeyman, the Lee Atwater story. Listener Terry Krugman from Atlanta followed up with an excellent example of the Southern strategy in action.
Ronald Reagan, beginning his campaign in 1980, and of all places, Philadelphia, Mississippi, which was known for one thing and one thing only, the murder of three civil rights workers in 1963. Reagan spoke about states' rights in coded words, sending a message to conservatives across the country that his message was the right one.
Thanks for the call, Terry. And you did nail it. In fact, we asked Stefan Forbes about that stop at the Neshoba County Fair, but the audio quality of the clip was terrible. So it didn't make the edit. After hearing so much about Atwater's calculated leaks, accusations, and targeted messaging, I asked AJC reporter Greg Bluestein and Andra Gillespie, Associate Professor of Political Science at Emory, about whether calling Georgia blue today is part of a strategy.
So, I mean, I think part of it is sort of calling things that aren't as though they were, but, I mean, it's not totally out of thin air.
Stacey Abrams likes to say, we are a blue state, we're just confused. We'll find out in November if that's the case.
Just ahead, we explore the King of Greens with Chef Todd Richards. This is On Second Thought. From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. Usually, a bug in your food is a pretty bad sign, but for people across the world, it's there on purpose. We spoke to Marianne Shockley, an entomologist at the University of Georgia who studies edible insects and who spearheaded the Eating Insects Athens 2018 conference, featuring some of her favorite bugs for eating.
Just at this conference, there were philosophers, there were people from food chemistry and nutrition, there were people from animal and dairy science departments, poultry science departments, entomology, business school, marketing, psychology, anthropology. Really, there's so much space in this field, and it's kind of two-tiered. We have insects for food, so consumption for you and I as humans, but we also have insects for feed, and so there is a lot of people really interested in using insects for waste management or for organic waste streams, food streams, and things like that. So lots of different minds together really kind of looking at these big questions.
Philosophers?
Ethics of eating insects. And it's something that, you know, we have to be aware of. It needs to be on our radar. Insects are invertebrates, and so we're not really on PETA's radar or anything like that. When we do research with insects, we don't necessarily have to have, you know, animal subjects review boards or whatnot like our vertebrate colleagues do if they're working with mice or rabbits or something. So we're in a little bit of a different sphere as researchers, but we do still need to be aware of it, and if we're trying to direct our narrative, let's just say towards vegans, who are vegans for a very specific reason of, let's just say, animal cruelty. There are many reasons that people are vegans, of course. Then we need to have a good answer to that question. You know, are insects raised ethically? Are they harvested ethically? Are they processed ethically? Do they feel pain? We don't know a lot of those answers to those questions, especially when you start dealing, you know, with the humanity side of insects and how they think and feel. So once again, just need to be aware and keep our minds open.
Why do you think the movement for eating insects has grown in recent years? Is it indeed a lack of supply for food supply, cost of food supply? Why has it become a thing?
I'd say it's two-tiered. So in 2013, the United Nations and the Food Aid Organization released this huge report about alternative protein sources. And the preemptus behind that particular season, was many of our RUTFs, or ready-for-use therapeutic foods that we use in food aid programs. They're basically protein bars that a lot of times, or some sort of a porridge or something, and the proteins are plant proteins, most specifically peanut proteins. And if something happens to that crop, let's just say Georgia is, you know, a very high producer of peanuts, if we have a bad summer and we don't have the crop that needs to go into all of these different food aid programs around the world, then there's a bottleneck, and now we're having starvation issues, and there's so many options. Why are we limiting ourselves to creating something that could collapse on us? And so really it's the expansion of what's in our toolbox. We're not wanting converts. We really just want, you know, like you have Meatless Monday, maybe we can have like Buggy Thursday.
But I think for a lot of people, there are probably some psychological or social or cultural hurdles to get over. So how do you walk people through that process?
A lot of it is education, and people are very food is emotional, and food is very, you know, familial and cultural. So you have to kind of keep all of that kind of at the front of your thoughts when you're talking to people. Or I don't try to convince people to eat insects. I don't feel that that's my role. I'm here to educate about insects as beautiful creatures, and let people know that they are edible if and when they choose to try.
What are some of the insects that we get here in Georgia or in the Southeast that would be good for eating?
So we have several large cricket farms here in Georgia that are supporting this industry, which is very, very exciting. There's been a shift, or not a shift, but I guess an addition with a lot of farms that are rearing for the animal industry, for their pets and their reptiles and things, that have put in a food grade line.
Okay, Dr. Marianne Shockley, what have you got for us today?
All right, I have an assortment of delicious and nutritious edible insects, ranging from whole grasshoppers, these are chapulines from Oaxaca, Mexico. They're made with a wonderful chili and garlic and lime, which gives them just a fantastic flavor. Another different type of whole insect, these are whole crickets from Intima Farms in Canada. So if you're wanting to do something with the whole roasted cricket, this would be your base. So a lot of what happens is once you have the ground into a powder, you can start incorporating it into a lot of these different ideas. So we've got several different types of protein bars that simply have ground powdered crickets incorporated.
So it's used like a flour kind of thing?
Not necessarily a flour, because that has an underlying assumption there's a leavening agent. Mm-hmm. So it's just protein powder. I usually add about a tablespoon to whatever I'm creating. So if it's muffins, brownies, my pizza dough, my biscuits, my marinara, whatever. It that's enough that it doesn't change the chemistry or the consistency or the texture of what I'm already preparing.
And chips.
Chips. Just your tortilla chips. Everyone loves tortilla chips. But once again, you can have just your plain corn tortilla chips, or feel good about having some extra protein.
You said you incorporate this into your cooking. Do you
eat? I do. So my kids probably eat way too many bugs. My college kids, as well as my personal family. But it's just kind of fun, and they're always around.
cricket protein bars. There's a banana flavor and an apple cinnamon. I think I'm going to go for the chapul, which seems, it's peanut butter and chocolate. And the first couple ingredients are organic coconut nectar, peanut butter, date. Blah, blah, blah. Crickets are way down there. I'm gonna eat this now. It looks like your average protein bar. Dense. I don't taste a lot of peanut butter, but I did it.
Do you taste crickets at all?
I don't know what crickets taste.
Well, that's a good thing.
That is UGA entomology professor Marianne Shockley. She was a primary organizer of the Eating Insects Athens 2018 conference. And those critter snacks? Actually, pretty good. We'd like to know, have you ever eaten an insect? Or would you? Call us at 404-500-9457 or leave us a comment on Facebook or on Twitter. And now to a kitchen that I really want to hang out in. This week we debuted Main Ingredients, a new series of conversations with chefs about one essential Southern ingredient. Todd Richards, author of the cookbook Soul, kicked us off with collard greens.
It's not rare for chefs to have food as part of our art form.
Where Popeye sports an anchor tattoo, Todd Richards shows his love for a Southern staple.
Collard greens are to me the king of greens. They stand strong. They grow in wintertime. They grow in spring as well, but they just stand strong. They're broad shoulders. They have a regal quality about them, because as you know, the outer leaves get broader, the inner ones get so small and tender. And they're like the linchpin of all things. You know, you have the salty ham, you have the sweet potatoes, you have the creamy mac and cheese. But collard greens is that vegetable that just absorb all those things and make them even more delicious.
And he can go on about this food that Southerners have depended on for generations. Not so much in the North.
Yeah, what is what? Cook up some bacon next.
Todd, I grew up in New England, and I did
not too many collard greens in New England, I'm sure.
I actually didn't know that garlic didn't come in a shaker until I was about 18.
Okay.
So my mom was not a great cook, and I'm going to tell you that we had never had collard greens on the table.
Well, that's an American tragedy in the making.
How did you learn how to make collard greens?
I learned how to make collard greens from my grandmother. And in the neighborhood, there's many grandmothers. So there's always a different versions of it. My grandmother was just ham hock, onions, vinegar, salt, pepper, collard greens that she washed in the sink. Washed them three times, regardless of how clean they were. They always washed three times. On the third time, some of that water would go into the pot, because if you understand collard greens and washing them, that the more water it gets agitated, the more alive they come. So you don't want to leave all that washed water just there if it's really, really clean. So we'll use that as well. And the agitation process too, you see the chlorophyll starting to seep out in the water, and you just never want to lose that essence, according to my grandmother. Next door was same ingredients with the addition of bacon fat and different kinds of seasoning salts. So it could have been Lowry seasoning salt, being from Chicago, that makes sense. Onion powder, garlic powder, those things were incorporated as well. As I got older, smoked turkey replaced ham hocks. As I got older, my grandmother didn't cook large collard greens. She cooked smaller collard greens, just sauteing them with a little bit of bacon, onion, apple cider vinegar, and sea salt. I always say that my grandmother was using sea salt when I was 6, 7, 8 years old. You know, she was probably more avant-garde than most chefs, you know, at that time.
Chef Richards has looked over many pots of greens since then. I visited his sleek, spotless home kitchen, where he put together a breakfast sandwich, fried egg, bacon, and the star of today's show, collard greens.
Nothing like an egg hitting the pan. Use the leaves, of course, for it. And it's really the perfect sandwich for me. I'm not a big lettuce person, but I love greens on there because it gives texture and body, and also gives a good amount of flavor to the dish as well.
So when you're cooking it, what is that? You know, like on top of greens, there's like this foamy stuff that comes up, and it always looks, I don't know, slightly kind of dingy.
Well, what happens is that the greens are breaking down, and typically, if you cook them very rapidly, you will have that rise to the top. We usually just skim the top of it away. But also, if you're using fat, what happens is that attaches to the fat, and as the pot cools down, you know, the temperature of the pot is less at the top than it is at the bottom. So then the fat is pulling all that impurity, what we consider impurity, to the top, and we just skim it and take it off. Just like if you're making chicken stock, if you want to do a clarified chicken stock, you would do the same exact process.
Mm-hmm. Part of the thing that you're known for is taking these traditional Southern ingredients like collard greens and using them in ways that people wouldn't think of. When you were a chef in these hoity-toity restaurants, when you were sort of, you know, woodshedding, learning how to do this stuff, mm-hmm. was there any part of you that felt like, ugh, can't talk about collard greens because that's, you know, poor people food or something?
My first job in a hotel, my first day, a chef asked me, what was my purpose of being in the kitchen? And was I going to just make soul food, as in fried chicken, mac and cheese, collard greens, anything of the sort? As he was saying that it was not as good as the cuisine that we're preparing there at the restaurant, which was French food. And probably through the first 10 years of my career, I felt that soul food was not good enough, based off of that one, here I am in the most luxurious hotel in Atlanta, that this chef is asking me, am I going to just cook basically black food? And it's not going to be good enough to be a chef in this hotel. And later on in my career, what I started to really understand is that from the technique standpoint, that the technique wasn't quite different from French food to the same way that my grandmother or my mother or my dad was cooking food, or the lady next door to us was cooking food. In a sense, my dad used to fill the sink with water, put spices in there, put the chickens in there before he smoked them. He would sit them in all this brine while the ribs are going. So they would sit there for, you know, 6-7 hours, you know, getting ready for a barbecue. So my dad was brining chicken, you know, when I was a kid. And he would only use one side of the smoker for chicken because it was all, you know, it was a little bit hotter than the other side. So the technique wasn't different than anyone else that I was doing. My mom, the way she made catfish, it only could be fried at 325 degrees. She would never stray away from that. And she would measure out each ingredient. It was more than just a pinch of this and a pinch of that. She was actually measuring how my great aunt who makes cakes, who still at 94 bakes, you know, 5-6 cakes a week, coconut cake, pound cake, 30-day cake. So she is a prolific baker at 94. So her cooking or pastry techniques are no different than anyone else. So that's when how it really changes. When I feel like, well, you know, you're not teaching me anything new because my parents already taught me this as a kid. And the requirement that it had to be delicious to go on a table was even a bigger part of the conversation. So you weren't teaching me any new standards because they were already inherited part of me growing up as a kid.
So did you put a little paprika or something on that egg? Looks like it's got a little color.
Yes, it has a little bit of cayenne pepper.
Oh, cayenne pepper. So you're loading us up with spicy stuff.
Yeah, but it's really great.
What are you going to do with that sandwich?
I'm going to cut it in half and give you guys some. While I sip on a glass of champagne, of course.
As I devour my delicious breakfast sandwich, Chef Richards finishes his breakfast bubbly. It's a daily ritual that he began after a series of family tragedies years ago. Like tending the sturdy collard greens in his garden, sipping champagne in the morning gives him balance.
You can be miserable with all the listenings of instant news, Instagram, instant things, or you can just take a little bit of time for yourself each and every day and be fortunate that someone loves you as much as they do, and that you can always find a way to love yourself regardless of any situation. And that's how I do it. I just have a glass of champagne, I go out to the garden, and I just really start my day in the most positive way I know how.
That was Atlanta-based chef and cookbook author Todd Richards. Thank you so much to all of you who have responded with your ideas and comments and feedback, either by calling us at 404-500-9457, reaching us on Twitter at OSD Talk, or joining our Facebook group. We are so encouraged by your comments and have probably way too many ideas for our little staff to handle, but keep them coming. And that is our show for today. On Second Thought is produced by Elena Rivera, Leighton Rowell, and LaRaven Taylor. Tyler Morris is technical director, and Sean Powers is our senior producer. Don Smith edits the show. Our theme song is by Alex Crispin and Marshall Ruffin. I'm Virginia Prescott. Thanks for spending some time with us today, and have a beautiful weekend. This is On Second Thought.